It was the beginning of September 1941, almost 2 years to the day since the German motorcycles had sped through the streets of our town, when Elsa stormed excitedly into the house to tell me of a boys' camp that had been formed by the SS. Ilse always had the news first, since she lived near the Kultusgemeinde, the Jewish community center, where all the news circulated. Ilse and her mother had visited the camp the previous day, and she told me that there were 30 Jewish boys in it. "It really is not bad at all," Ilse informed me. "You know, you think of a camp in terms of all the stories you hear." Ilse asked me to visit the camp with her the following day. I declined. That evening, Papa said to me, "I'm surprised at you. Why don't you want to go? Do you realize Arthur might be in a camp like that, and how glad he would be if someone would visit him?" That did it. Together with her mother, Ilse and I went late the next afternoon to the camp. It was only a short distance from Bielitz and could easily be reached from our house by a shortcut which led over the meadows and several small brooks. The camp, a converted factory, was a big square four-story building with a yard in the center. An old German guard stood at the entrance, and when we told him what we wanted, he let us in. Mrs. Kleinsoller, Ilse's mother, knew one of the boys and started talking to him. I felt quite lost. I walked over to a window, pretending to look out, but I was curious to see the boys. I had seen few Jewish boys since the transport had left. Their room was big, one side of it occupied by a row of bunks. There were family photographs tacked to the wall over the bunks. An oblong table stood in the center of the room, and a few of the boys were eating. I felt so self-conscious I did not know what to do with myself. Ilse stood in a far corner with her mother, and I did not have the courage to cross the room. I felt that everyone would watch me. Suddenly a tall man of perhaps 30 with a Red Cross band around his arm, either a doctor or a male nurse, approached me, introduced himself, and asked whether I was from Bielitz. He told me that he had lived here for several years. We discovered that we had quite a number of friends in common. As we talked, I became uncomfortably conscious of a man watching me from a nearby bunk and intermittently writing. He would write a couple of lines, then look at me, write, then look again. He was slim, wore a navy blue shirt and gray slacks. He had a tan, lean face, a prominent nose, a cynical mouth, and a determined chin. When he looked up, his eyes behind his horn-rimmed glasses were steel gray, searching and seemingly cold. His hair was dark and wavy. What struck me most forcibly were his fingers. They were long and nervous. I felt uneasy under his searching eyes. The man to whom I was talking told me that antique furniture, paintings, and other valuables from the homes of Jews who had been liquidated were stored in the factory. Here they were repaired and refinished, if necessary, and then sent to furnish the apartments of German officers. "We have quite a collection of paintings," he said. "Would you care to see them?"
"I would love to," I replied.
We went up two flights. He opened a heavy door, and we entered the storeroom. In the fading afternoon light, I saw beautiful paintings, vases, inlaid tables, marble-topped consoles, Chinese curios, pianos, tapestries, treasures from many homes. They were covered with dust. I fancied that I had seen some of the things before in the houses of friends. As I was admiring an inlaid table, my companion was called away. I wandered alone among the furniture until I came to a corner of the room, where, behind a piano, I saw a life-size portrait of a beautiful girl holding a torch. Her hair was hanging about her shoulders, her eyes shone with a strange power of hope and conviction. She was so incredibly beautiful that I gasped. I had never seen hope, power, and determination thus expressed. The faint light coming through the dusty windows illuminated the canvas to perfection.
"Isn't it beautiful?"
said a voice behind me.
"I wonder who put her there," I said without turning around. I was carried away by my emotions.
"I did."
The voice was nearer now. I turned around, and there he stood, the stranger with the penetrating gray eyes. I was annoyed that he was there, and yet pleased that he understood what I meant.
"What would you call her?"
he asked.
Hope, I said without hesitation.
Or wisdom, he added. Come, I will show you something.
He led me to the other end of the storeroom. In a corner stood an easel, a canvas on it, with a half-finished painting. Do you paint? I guessed.
A little, he answered. Stand there as you did in front of the picture, he ordered.
I started to laugh. He took my hand and pressed it firmly.
You are going to sit for me, he commanded with a determination that I disliked.
No, I said, just as determined, and started down the stairs. Ilsa and her mother were ready to leave. We said our goodbyes, and I returned to the imperious artist. I hope you can keep the picture in its hiding place for a long time.
Our picture, he replied.
I felt like fighting with him, but restrained myself.
I will take you home, he said, turning to Mrs. Kleinsoller and Ilse.
As we left the building, he turned to me and said,
By the way, we were not properly introduced.
His name was Abeck Feigenblatt. I wanted to know more about him, yet I was afraid to ask. I was curiously disturbed, annoyed, and yet pleased. He must be around 30, I thought, practically an old man. Just then he asked how old I was. 16, I said, but corrected myself. Almost 17. He smiled.
Well, I will see you soon, he said.
Perhaps. I was not too encouraging.
I know I will,
was his confident reply as he waved goodbye. Nervous, excited, and feeling foolish, I turned and entered our house. Chapter 8.
The following Sunday, Papa decided that he would go with me to the cemetery. It was the only place where Jews could freely enjoy nature. Until that Sunday, Papa and Mama had shown no desire to visit it, even though their parents were buried there. But Papa had been confined to the house so much he longed to see green trees and breathe fresh air. We visited the old section of the cemetery that I liked best. It had not been tended for years, and a thick, untrimmed hedge ran all around it. Many of the stones, we noted, were sinking deep into the earth. Papa read the barely legible Hebrew inscriptions and translated them for me. Suddenly we heard somebody approaching. Looking up, I saw Abeck. After I had introduced him to Papa, he said that he had met Eskia strolling along one of the paths, and she had told him that Papa and I were nearby.
I wanted to see you, he said simply. I felt Papa's swift, questioning glance, but he did not say anything. When Abeck learned that we had been reading the inscriptions on the stones, he addressed Papa in fluent Hebrew. This seemed the right moment for me to get away.
I am sure that you and Papa will get along fine without me. I want to see Ilse anyway, I said, and ran as fast as I could. After an hour or so, I saw Papa and Abeck coming down the path leading to Eskia's home, talking with great animation. Papa was glad to find someone he could talk to about the study of Hebrew.
Just imagine, he told me. Abeck has a book that I have wanted to read for a long time. Now I can finally get it.
I'm very glad, I said unenthusiastically. But I think we ought to go home. Mama will be waiting. Papa looked at me curiously. I usually urged him to stay out longer. He spent too much of his time in the damp cellar room.
Let us go home, then, he agreed.
I'll see you very soon, Abeck said in farewell. We walked home in silence.
Papa told Mama of the encounter with Abeck and how glad he was to have found another Hebrew scholar. I was knitting and tried not to pay any attention. While Mama was fixing supper, Papa called me to his side. I want to talk to you about Abeck, he said quietly.
What about him?
I feigned indifference. I am convinced that the boy cares a lot for you.
Papa, you're talking silly. I don't even know him. I started to walk away.
Wait just 1 minute, he said. Abeck is a fine boy. I could see it during the short time that I spent with him. The fact that you hardly mentioned him is proof enough that you may care for him. I only ask one thing of you, whatever life may bring. Try not to make any decisions during this horrible war. Grow up slowly. Enjoy life. I want to see you laughing more than anything else. You have already cried enough in your young life. Several days later, when Abek came and brought Papa the book he had promised, I made it my business not to remain at home. Papa was quite annoyed that I did not return until late, and he told me that Abek had asked about me several times. He had even offered to fetch me from Ilsa's house, where I had gone, but Papa had persuaded him to stay. The news from the Eastern Front was disheartening, and there were no letters from Arthur. This time we all knew much better how to conceal our concern. My girlfriends in Bielitz had heard from their brothers. Giese in Krakow wrote again and again, this time not kindling our hopes, but expecting comfort from us. One bright morning early in October, the mailman handed me two letters, one from a friend living in the government, the other, a square white envelope without a return address, addressed in black ink in unfamiliar writing. As I opened this one, the black ink seemed to be transformed into a rainbow of colors. Scribbled on a tiny sheet in Arthur's handwriting were a few words telling that he was well and working, and that he would write more as soon as the mail could go through normal channels again. Someone apparently had taken that note into the government, and a stranger had transmitted it to us from there. Papa's and Mama's eyes glittered with tears of joy. It was the second time Arthur had escaped the murderous Germans. That afternoon Abek came. In my happiness I was kind to him, and a different relationship developed. From then on he came almost daily. Inasmuch as he worked outside the camp, restoring paintings and hanging them in German homes, he came and went unchallenged. He seemed to enjoy more privileges than anybody else in camp, perhaps because he painted portraits for the guards. He brought me books, and we had many discussions. Often, after having talked to me for several hours, he would return to camp only to write me a lengthy letter. Life had new meaning and became more and more interesting. Abek no longer assumed the superior air with me that he employed in talking to others, but unconsciously fell into the role of older brother. He was 6 years older than I, but this difference in age, which at first had seemed greater to me, became less and less important. My parents were glad about Abek's coming. Papa had someone to talk to, and they knew it was very good for me to have a friend. Toward the end of October, we received our first direct letter from Arthur since the Germans had attacked Russia. It was not much different from his earlier brief note. He was working in a chemical plant and was well. Though he assured us that we were not to worry about him, I thought I detected a reference to hardship. November came with lots of snow and frost, and we had to face the prospect of a bleak, heatless winter with little food. One morning Ilse arrived, completely out of breath. After she recovered, she told us that a policeman had seen her beautiful piano and had ordered her to turn it over to him. With tears in her eyes, she said, "Please come home with me, Goethe. I want to play it for the last time." Since Jews were not allowed on buses, we had an hour's walk in a bitter wind. After the ordeal, Ilse's house was a haven of warmth. Her grandparents and mother anxiously inquired about my parents. Ilse's little sister Kitty, a sweet child with large dark eyes and piquant pointed face, cuddled on my lap and asked to be told stories until finally Mrs. Kleinsoller called her away. The grown-ups left the room and I stayed alone with Ilse. She sat down at the piano. I settled into the deep wine-colored couch and listened to her playing. The snowy wind was howling at the windows, and by 4 o'clock it began to grow dark. Ilse did not turn on the light. She kept on playing without pause. First gay waltzes, then stormy polonaises, Chopin's funeral march, lilting dance melodies. Her choices reflected our many moods. When the street lamps across the road were lighted, their dim light fell on Ilse and created a grotesque shadow on her on the polished wood of the piano. She was now completely absorbed, giving herself entirely to her music. Away from her piano, Ilse was shy and withdrawn. Only through her music was she able to express herself openly. Her music seemed to ask over and over again that painful why that our hearts kept asking. And that why she asked with bluish lips 3.5 years later in another darkness, in a wet, cold meadow as she died in my arms, having barely turned 18.
The door opened slowly. I was not conscious of Abex entering. Without saying a word, he sat next to me. Ilsa continued her playing. He put my hand in his and kept it there. I tried gently to withdraw it, but when I saw his eyes, I stopped. With both hands, he held my trembling fingers. Then I felt his warm breath and his quivering lips upon my hands. First, very gently, then with growing passion, he kissed each finger and each nail. I looked at him, but he didn't seem to see me. Finally, Ilsa stopped playing, rose from the piano and turned on a lamp. I was glad for the break and jumped up and went to her. For a moment nobody spoke. Then Ilsa offered us tea. I said I would prefer to go home before my parents began worrying about me. Then I asked Abek how he had known where I was. He told me he had been to my home and my parents had told him. He offered to take me back again. I replied that it wasn't necessary. Besides, although I didn't tell him so, I didn't like to be with him on the streets. I always felt his humiliation when we met German soldiers and he had to take his hat off and step down from the sidewalk to let them pass. Abek, possibly because he sensed my feelings, suggested we take a new route home, along a road just being built. Since there were no sidewalks in yet, there would be little traffic, and almost no likelihood of meeting Germans. After saying goodbye to Ilsa, off we went. The wind had stopped. It was snowing gently. Abek started to tell me about his family. They lived in Sosnowiec, about 45 kilometers north of Bielitz. His parents were very old. He had 6 sisters and 3 brothers, all much older than he. His religious training had been Orthodox, and he had rejected it without finding peace in his more liberal outlook. He had never been more talkative. All at once he interrupted himself, and in his mocking, ironical way he quoted the final words of a famous Hebrew poem written by an Orthodox Jew turned Reformed, who, like Abek, had never quite found himself in his new environment. "And even if I wear the silken shirt and assume modern manners, happy and full of joy I will never be." And that was the portrait of Abek's soul. The chains of the ghettos bound him, and the bitterness and the ironical smile were a mask to hide his self-consciousness. At that moment I pitied him, even though both of us were now bound by the same chains. His childhood had been different from mine. I had known a happiness and freedom that he had never known. He continued, "For you, religion is something wonderful. It's a port in a troubled sea. It's a clean, pure feeling. You believe, and still you are free. But for me..." He didn't have to say it. I knew now how he felt. We reached home, and I said I had better go in. "But," he said, "there is so much yet I want to tell you." I said, "I will just go in and tell my parents that I am here." He continued to talk, and when I finally said good night, he pulled me gently toward him. I tried to pull from his embrace, but his arms were like steel. I was afraid that he would try to kiss me. However, he didn't try. With his lips close to mine, he said, "There is something I want to tell you. It has been on my mind for a long time. I would much prefer to say nothing, but tomorrow may be too late." "What about tomorrow?" I exclaimed. He picked up my thought. "I might be sent away from here. Perhaps tomorrow, perhaps the day after. Nobody knows, and therefore I have to tell you how much I love you. Life does not have much value these days, and mine has none at all. But having you makes me want to live. But answer me, do you love me too?" I couldn't speak. I liked Abek very much. I respected his intelligence and judgment. He was the best friend I had ever had, and now I knew that friend was gone. I searched for an answer, for an impetuous, happy, bubbling answer, but there was none. Then his voice came again as from another world. You can make me the happiest man in the world. Pointing to the yellow star and the word Jew over his heart, he continued, In spite of this, love is all that matters. My parents wrote me today that they approve wholeheartedly. What? I said. You wrote to your parents? Oh, I had to, he said, before I asked you. Please don't misunderstand me, he continued. I don't want to marry you now. That would be stupid and selfish. All I want is your promise to marry me after the war. It will give me all the courage I need to get through.
Your question is quite unexpected, I said in a hoarse voice, and you're asking much too much of me. You know I like you, but I don't know if that is love. I can't tell you yes because I would be lying, and besides, I feel since you asked your parents, I am entitled to do the same. My only wish was to escape. I must go now, I said, and think about it. There was a lump in my throat.
I'll see you tomorrow, he said.
I turned toward our house in bewilderment. Instinctively, I felt that I could never love Abek. He did not possess the strength that I had known in my father and brother, and that I expected in the man I would love. Had he held me in his arms and told me that he would take care of me and shield me, had he not asked me to kiss him but kissed me masterfully and assuredly, I might have given him the answer he wanted, but his weakness shattered my illusions. I went to bed early and pretended to sleep, but I kept thinking about the proposal. No, it wasn't at all the way I imagined it would happen. There were no gay garden parties and music and dancing in the starlight. What Abek offered me was probably deeper and truer than anything else I could expect, but it wasn't what I was looking for. I hadn't asked for it. He wants to marry me, I said over and over to myself. He said I could make him happy. Then I understood the cause of my sadness. I didn't want to make anybody happy. I wanted someone to make me happy. I knew that there was laughter, and I wanted someone who could laugh with me. I remembered the poem that Abek had quoted, and I knew that the man at my side could not be Abek. I sat up in bed and called Papa and Mama, and I told them about Abek.
What did you answer? Papa asked me.
Nothing yet, Papa. I'm supposed to give him my answer tomorrow, and I'm quite sure it will be no. And then I grew angry. I felt that Abek didn't have the right to ask me what he did, didn't have the right to disturb my peace and that of my family. I dismissed the argument that tomorrow it might be too late, that he might be sent away. I was aware only of my feeling, not of his, and I felt quite sorry for myself.
I must have made a dramatic picture sitting cross-legged in an outgrown nightgown in the mildewed basement of our home. There were Papa and Mama, too old for their years, looking at their child to whom love had just been offered, and one floor above us was the room where 25 years before Papa had offered Mama his love. Papa probably understood Abek best. He had been about to go to the front in the First World War when he had told Mama of his love. He didn't want to marry her then for fear that he might leave her a widow. But he, too, had wanted her word and something to come back to. Looking at Mama now, was he thinking of that winter night when he asked her, and she, full of happiness, accepted? And was Mama thinking of that day, too, remembering the happiness she had felt, and how the war hadn't really mattered because she had known that she would be his wife? Finally, I fell asleep. When I awoke at dawn, Mama and Papa were talking in whispers. Mama seemed to be taking Abek's side, but Papa was more critical. And again and again the words war and abnormal entered the conversation. Then Papa said, I'm afraid she loves him. Mama answered, No, she doesn't. If she did, she would be happy. That afternoon Abek came. He looked pale and tired. I was very self-conscious and could not look into his eyes. Fortunately, Ilse appeared a few minutes later to tell us how the Germans had come for the piano. Much as I sympathized with her, for once I was glad not to have to carry the burden of conversation. After an awkward hour in which Abek and I both felt dejected and ill at ease, Ilsa sensed that something was amiss and said that she had to go home. I arose to go with her. To my dismay, Abek insisted on accompanying us. We walked with Ilsa less than halfway when I decided to return home. There was no use, I had to face him. As soon as Ilsa was out of earshot, Abek's voice grew soft. "I'm sorry," he said, and I winced. I had known he would apologize. "I should not have said it yesterday." His voice betrayed anxiety. "Have you got an answer?" I could not bring myself to say no. I hated the idea of losing him completely. If only we could simply be friends. "One does not change one's feelings overnight," I heard myself saying. "I would like to continue seeing you, but I think it would be better if you didn't mention love until after the war." He was biting his lip, and there was suffering in his eyes as he nodded silently. I knew that I would not be carefree with him again. It was getting dark as we approached our house. At our fence I looked wistfully toward my beloved garden, now covered by snow. The trees seemed grotesque, silhouetted against the darkening sky. Only the pines looked merry, spreading their branches like wings toward the heavens. "How beautiful," I breathed, enchanted with the picture. "How beautiful," Abek repeated. I was in his arms. I struggled to free myself. His lips brushed my cheek. "Leave me alone," I cried out. Instantly his arms released me. "I'm sorry," he muttered, and without another word he left. That was more effective than anything else he could have done. I was sorry to see him go, afraid I might never see him again. By that one abrupt gesture he gained more of me than by all of his devotion. He appeared mysterious, desirable. As I reached the house, he returned. "I forgot to give you something." His voice was steady and quiet. He pulled a small package out of his breast pocket. "What is it?" I asked in surprise. "A book that I found that I thought you would like." "Thank you," I said a bit too eagerly. "Good night." I held out my hand to him. He gripped it.
"Good night," he said. "I'm sorry about before. I will try not to do it again."
When I stood alone again, I wished he had not come back. I wished he were not sorry. Why hadn't he taken me in his arms and kissed me, not caring about my protests? I stooped and scooped up a handful of the fresh snow and wiped my face with it. It was refreshing and felt good. Inside, I opened the gift. It was a thin volume of Chinese love poems. As I read the beautiful words, I thought again of Abek, with annoyance. Chapter 9. Several weeks went by, and the year 1941 was drawing to a close. I still saw Abek almost daily, although for a while our meetings consisted chiefly of awkward silences. Then, gradually, I was able to laugh and joke with him once again, even though always aware that he wanted to marry me, that he interpreted each pleasant word or gesture as a sign that I might be changing my attitude. In December, I got a letter from a former classmate of mine, Erica. Erica, her parents, and little brother had fled Bielitz shortly before the Germans came and were living in a small town in the Guberment, near the former Polish-Russian border. Erica and I looked very much alike and were often mistaken for one another. We had never been close friends, but now, in these tragic, lonely times, as I wrote to even casual acquaintances, I began to realize how much Erica and I had in common. Thinking back to our school days and how she used to rise to answer the teacher's questions, I again saw her straight back, clad in the regulation navy serge, the short bob of her black hair, the dimples in her somewhat pale face. I knew her as Erica, who flung her books over her shoulder. Erica, who preferred milk hot rather than cold,
Erica, who had a daring wish to wear a red dress to school just once instead of that navy blue. That was all I knew of Erica. Yet she had thoughts so like mine, which were never spoken. Only now, when several hundred miles were between us, did she sit down in an alien room at a strange table to write these thoughts that I understood. Her letter was different from so many others. There was no longing for the school years in it or for friends we both had lost. I am in love. We want to get married. Hennick is everything I ever dreamed of and more, much more. My parents oppose. Can you understand why? My own parents, who always claim to love me and to want my happiness only. His parents understand how we feel. One never knows how many months or weeks we can have together. Why make it hard for us? I wish we could run away, but how? Where to? One needs identifications. But I am sure that in the end my parents will give their consent, and I will be the happiest girl in the world. I brooded over that letter, examining it in the light of my feelings toward Abek. Erica was in love, I decided. I was not. I waited to hear more from Erica, hoping that her parents would understand her, and then I realized with shock that I, a mere 17, would have a married woman as a friend. Abek seemed to depend more and more on me. I fully realized this shortly before Christmas when he told me that there was a good chance he might go home for the holidays. The guards took a week or so off, and since most of them lived in Sosnovyets, Abek's hometown and that of most of the boys in camp, they might take the boys home. He was quite excited when he told me about the possibility. "Oh, I'm sure you will go," I answered in my light-hearted manner. The following day he came later than usual, explaining that he had had to pack for the trip. I told him how glad I was for him and asked when he had learned he would be going. "You told me yesterday," he said in a matter-of-fact tone. "What do you mean?" I demanded, bewildered. "I believe in your intuition," was his simple reply. He presented me with another book before he left. I found his picture between the pages and an underlined sentence which read, "What the heart and even mind won't do, time will settle if given a chance." I tried to interpret the statement in various ways, but it boiled down to the same thing. I showed it to Papa. "Well," he said with a smile, "I am glad that at least you're giving yourself time." Abek was to stay away for a week, but on the fourth evening after he had left there was a knock on our door, and there he stood. Still standing in the doorway, he whispered, "I could not stand it any longer. I had to come back." None of us offered a warm welcome. "What about your parents?" Mama asked pointedly. We all knew only too well that each furlough might be the last one that he would spend with his family. "Your parents surely minded," Papa said, looking sternly at Abek. "No, not at all. They understand. They love you too, Gerda." I looked away, but in a flash I saw Papa's glance meeting Mama's bewildered look. Blood shot into my cheeks. Abek had never spoken of his feelings in front of my parents. There was a meaningful silence which Mama interrupted with, "I'd better start supper." I stood at the window, trembling. Abek took off his coat, then came toward me. "You did come to a decision." I did not answer. "You love me, don't you? When I was away, you knew you did." I still did not answer. "That's why I came back." There was pain in his voice. The anticipation was gone. "Abek, why must you do this? Why must you do this to me?" After Abek left, I felt uneasiness in the silence. I knew Papa was angry. Years before, when I had been naughty during the day, I had waited for the after-supper hour when Papa would discuss my offense. Punishment was never severe. To know that Papa was displeased was often enough. This evening, after dinner, Mama resumed her knitting. Papa filled his pipe and tried again and again to light it. The tobacco was poor and would not light. Papa emptied the bowl painstakingly and started to refill it, packing it not quite so firmly. Mama looked up from her knitting.
Questioningly, she looked at Papa. He did not speak, not yet. The pipe was filled now. Papa tore a piece of paper into a long shred, held it over the chimney of the kerosene lamp. The paper caught fire. The tobacco crackled. It caught. I waited. "But Papa knows," I was saying to myself. "Papa knows everything about Abek. Why is he angry with me now?" Slowly the smoke puffed. "I don't like it," Papa said. That set me off. "I don't like it either," I broke out. "What should I do, Papa? What shall I do?"
"He's a nice boy."
It was like a justification from Papa.
Then I started to cry.
Papa pulled me over toward him, his hand stroking my hair, his frayed sleeve brushing over my eyes. "Papa, what did I do wrong? I want to see Abek, I told him that, but I don't want to be bound, tied. Papa, am I wrong? Tell me, Papa."
I don't think Papa ever thought me wrong. After a while, he said, "That still does not make it right for the boy."
Christmas passed, and 1942 began, terrifyingly cold with lots of snow. I couldn't recall so severe a winter. Early in the new year, my mother's uncle died. Papa went to the funeral. Mama stayed with the widow while a grave was hastily dug. A few quiet prayers said, a handful of earth thrown on a crude casket. I was home alone, waiting for Papa and Mama, when a letter came. There was no return address on it. The handwriting looked like Erica's. I was afraid to open it. Somehow I felt that this letter did not contain the happy news of a marriage. When I finally tore the envelope open, my fears were confirmed. In it were a few tattered pages from a child's notebook, some of the letters big, as if written by a six-year-old, others tiny, although there were no marks of tears. The letter seemed to vibrate with pain. Here is what I read. "It is dark outside. It is night. A deadly silence hangs over the house where 2 days ago there was so much life, so much dear life. I'm sitting on the floor to catch the little light that is falling from the tavern across the street to a patch on the floor. It is a dull patch of bluish light, and in it lies my paper. They are sitting in the tavern. They, the murderers. I am in the dark, alone in the dark. Just as my heart and soul will forever remain in the dark, and the light of those criminals, the light of their crime, illuminates the paper to let me write about their deeds.
Do you know what happened?"
"No, you don't know."
"Yesterday?"
"Yes, it was yesterday. Early in the morning we heard a lot of noise, screams and crying and begging for mercy. There were the cries of Jewish people in the streets. Quickly my father and I ran down the back stairs to hide in the basement, while Mother went to get the baby out of his crib. He was sleepily rubbing his eyes. He was so small he did not know that you had to be watchful even in your sleep, that night and day you must be on guard. Quickly, go and hide. Maybe he was dreaming of toys he never had. Maybe my mother did not wake him fast enough. I imagine how he stood rubbing his baby eyes when the murderers entered in their gray uniforms and took them both, my mother and the baby. He was not dressed because his little suit is still lying there on the chair. The pants of his pajamas are still lying there. He must have kicked them off and gone half naked. From the cellar we heard screams. Why does the world go on when things like this happen? We heard distant screams for hours and hours. Only when night fell, it was quiet. We hoped and we prayed that Mama and the child had found refuge somewhere. After it had been dark for hours, we crawled out of the cellar. The house was empty. Empty was our flat, empty the flats of all of our friends and that of the boy I loved. Where are they? We went to the street. We went to all the homes. We met a few ghost-like people who were swaying as if coming from another world. In one house we found an old man dressed in his garment of white in which to stand before God on the day of judgment. He was saying the prayer for the dead. We begged him to tell us what happened. He looked at us wild-eyed, pointed with his finger to heaven, and continued to pray. Like a sacred figure about to enter heaven, he stood there alone, around him in a world of sin and unspeakable crime. Finally, we met a young man who told us the tragic tale. Old people, young people, and children all had been taken to the marketplace. There they had undressed and lain naked on the stones, face down, and the murderers on horses and brandishing guns trampled on that screaming human pavement. Many were killed by the horseshoes. The whips left bloody traces. After the initial thirst of the sadists was satisfied, those who remained alive had to march naked outside town. They had to dig their own grave and stand on the rim until a hail of bullets killed them. Strangers embraced as they went to sleep forever. We went there. What were laws now forbidding Jews to leave the city limits? But nobody caught us or cared. The moon was shining. We saw a great square grave, half open yet, a mountain of naked bodies in it. Many we recognized. We found my mother. She was all bloody. We did not find my little brother. I found Henick, the one I loved more than life, who was to be my husband. I kissed his dead face. Not one tear did I shed in that grave. Only my heart died. Do you know what? If they would come tomorrow and kill my father, I would not care. I would not cry. I would be glad for him. I wish they would kill me. From now on, I will walk wherever it is not permitted. I want them to catch me. I want them to kill me because I don't care. There is only one thing that could stir within me. I want a gun. I want a knife. I want to kill, just kill. I have no feeling. It won't be a crime. Maybe it won't even give me satisfaction, but I want to kill. What are we waiting for? My father's hair is snowy white. He hasn't spoken or eaten or slept or cried. He's watching me while I write this. He's like an animal. I don't think he knows me. My little brother's clothes are there. I can't touch them. There is a brooch on my dress. A little heart that Henick gave me. There are no hearts. All hearts are dead. How does one bury a heart? I am writing something to you. It's good to tell it, but who are you? Are you alive? Didn't they murder you yet? Too bad if you have died. Then you would not get this letter from a girl named Erica who has a dead heart. I never heard from Erica again. Chapter 10. 2 tense weeks followed without news from Arthur. Troubled with the most horrible images of what might have happened to him, I had a hard battle with myself not to tell my parents about Erica's letter. Abek came one afternoon when I was alone, and I could stand it no longer. I told him everything, about my wakefulness at night, my nightmares when I slept, my frantic worry about Arthur. Then I read Erica's letter to him. For the first time in years, I felt unburdened by talking without reservation. He understood. He offered no empty words of comfort, but held me in his arms while I talked. When I finished and rested my head on his shoulder, he stroked my hair with loving caresses. He kissed my feverish forehead, my tear-streaked cheeks. I was comforted and at peace. I never liked him better or felt closer to him. "Everything will be all right," he whispered. Not looking up, not thinking, I said, "I know it will be, Arthur." I felt him grow rigid. I looked up. His face was stony. "Abek," I said, but I could not finish. Of course, he resented my indifference to him. The next morning, Arthur's long-awaited letter arrived. It contained no real news except a change of address. I thought his hand was not as regular as ever. I seemed to detect a certain strain.
Was it only my imagination? Surely Papa and Mama noticed it, too. If they did, they said nothing. I admired my brother's courage and strength, his ability to conceal everything that was painful. I imagined him sitting in some unknown dark room, late at night writing home those banal words while listening for dreaded footsteps, fearing tomorrow. And so the winter passed, with Arthur's frequent letters providing the only relief. Each day brought new announcements of deeper German penetrations into Russia. Far into the night, our knitting needles would click in a desperate race against the ever-worsening food and fuel shortages. But nothing depressed us as much as the chilling thought that no army seemed capable of stemming the German advance. Somehow winter seemed to be our enemy. Fervently we hoped for an early spring. Spring would mean that we would no longer need to worry how to heat our cellar. There would be more vegetables, more food. The days would be longer, the fearful nights shorter. But had I known what else the spring of 1942 would mean, I would have prayed that winter should last forever. On the morning of the 19th of April, all Jews were ordered to prepare to move to the shabby remote quarter of town near the railroad terminal. Here, where cattle and produce were unloaded, there were a few unoccupied, decrepit houses. In 2 short days, they would become our ghetto. Nobody said much. We all had expected it, but for Mama it was the hardest blow. She did not mind the cellar, for it was ours in the house of her childhood, in the house where she had been born, and her mother and grandmother before her, where she had married, where her parents had died, and her children were born. Now we had to leave it. Was it so hard to leave because we sensed that we would never return? Very early on the morning we were to leave, long before the hour when we were allowed to go out, I ran down the street to say goodbye to Nyanya. I crept up the creaking stairs and, without knocking gently, pushed the door. I knew it would be open. Nyanya was sitting at the window. Her long gray hair lay about her shoulders. The big shawl on which I had fallen asleep so many times was wrapped around her. She held her prayer book in one hand, her crucifix in the other. Without looking up, she continued to pray. I saw her in that early dawn like a figure in a beautiful, long-forgotten dream. At her feet was the little wooden stool on which I used to sit in childhood when she would tell me stories while she sewed dresses for my dolls. Her window box was then full of flowers. She used to say, "Those flowers are for you when you grow up." But Nyanya said nothing to me now. While she said her Pater Noster, I looked about the room I had known so well. There was the green pillow cover I had crocheted when I was 10. In her cupboard were the gleaming cups I had sipped from so often. I knew them all, the one with the purple flowers, the fat one with the picture of Emperor Franz Josef, the one with the tiny crack that Nyanya would not pour anything hot into. In her wooden wardrobe, dresses were hanging neatly. The brown one with the tiny glass buttons, the black one a bit shiny and frayed that she still wore to church. There was the fine black silk dress covered with a sheet. Nyanya often said that she would wear this one only 3 times. She had made it to wear at her granddaughter's wedding. She would wear it when I got married, and then forever in her coffin. On her night table there was a large Madonna in blue and gold with a flaming heart. She had brought it from a pilgrimage to Czestochowa. Nyanya's room was as orderly as ever. Nothing had changed in it since I could remember. I couldn't help but compare her comfortable room to our cellar home. I could picture our few pitiful bundles standing on the floor, several old blackened pots and pans, some mended clothes, a basket with a few dried peas, a loaf of bread, a little salt, a small jar of homemade jam, a little cocoa from before the war, the pot of chives under which the remains of our jewelry had been buried. Now Papa and Mama were tying the bundles in a sheet. That was all that remained from a beautiful home. I despised Nyanya at that moment for her security. She could stay, but we had to go.
With a harsh voice, I finally said, "I came to say goodbye, Nyanya. We have to go, you know. I hope I will see you soon again." I wanted to get out fast. Nyanya's deep voice went through me. "Gertle, come back." She called me by my childhood nickname. At the sound of that long-forgotten name, I felt a tightening in my throat. When I turned around, her work-worn hands stretched toward me. I ran into her embrace. She sat me on the little stool at her feet, her hard, calloused hands stroking my hair.
"My poor child," she said.
I put my head in her lap. I felt her warm tears on my hair. I felt my own tears start. Then the picture of our cellar room came back to me. "I have to go now, Nyanya," I said finally. She pushed me back into the chair, begging, "Stay, please, stay a little longer." "No, Nyanya, I have to go to Mama and Papa. They send you all their love. You know they cannot come. It's too dangerous." I embraced her once more and ran out. At home we sat silently. This was the last morning in our home. I could not stand it in the cellar. I went into the yard, and then I jumped over the fence into the garden which I had so loved. I did not care if anybody caught me. I had to see my beloved garden again. It had rained during the night, and the young, fresh grass was wet. I looked at the rich, moist soil under my feet. Everywhere memories surrounded me. On an old, tall branch was a piece of rotted string. I knew it. A few years before, Arthur had flown a kite. It stuck in the tree, and we had never got it down. Wind, snow, and rain had blown the paper away, but the little bit of string was still there. On the old pear tree there was a mark made by a scout knife driven into it years ago by Arthur. There had been a note under it that day reading, "I'm a prisoner of the Cow Cow tribe." We had played Indians and Arthur had been taken prisoner. That heroic sword and note were supposed to save him. The note was gone a long, long time, and Arthur was far, far away. There were the narrow, now overgrown paths where I rode my tricycle and wheeled my dolls. There was the little garden house, now badly in need of paint. We had used to paint it every spring. From one corner of its ceiling hung some faded yellowish paper. It had been a Japanese lantern in the shape of a full moon for my 15th birthday party. We had left it there because it looked so funny. Was it really only 3 years since Mama and Papa, young and gay, had stood arm in arm with Papa watching us eat ice cream and cake? How happy I had been that day! I ran down to the edge of the brook where I knew I could find violets, and there they were, in their velvety brilliance, fresh, untouched, and fragrant. I picked a bunch and held them tight, and then sat down on the moist ground and started to cry, thinking of the velvet lawn, of the yellow dandelions that soon would be blooming in abundance, thinking of the birds that sang in the trees at night, thinking of the blooming cherry trees, the red fruit hanging from the branches, of the rich autumn that would paint the leaves in bright hues, of the gleaming fruit, of the sunshine and rain that would come to my garden in all seasons. And all this we were not to see any more. There by the brook, thinking and crying softly, I bade farewell to my childhood. Then I walked toward the house, not the front entrance, but the side where the bedrooms faced. I did not care whether I was caught or not. I had to see my beloved home once more. A shade went up in my parents' room, and I saw the familiar cream-colored wallpaper. Soon Mama's head would appear, and she would say to Papa, "You'd better take your umbrella, Julius. In April, one never knows." Then she would come into my room, gently kiss my forehead. I would stretch, turn around, and sigh. "Take your raincoat to school today," she would say. I started to walk back now, not along the path, but over the young grass. Here was the plum tree with the funny twisted branch on which we used to swing. It felt wet, cool, and familiar. I sat on it, closed my eyes. For a moment, for one moment only, I will pretend that nothing has happened.
I leaned back, swinging on the old branch. I will go into the house now, I thought. They will be at the breakfast table, Mama pouring the hot coffee, Papa buttering his bun. Arthur will gather his books together and hurry to a lecture. The white cups will gleam on the table, crumbs will be scattered on the checkered cloth. Look at the lovely violets. Oh, they're perfect, Mama will exclaim. Go put them in the dining room. Which vase, Mama? Put them in the shallow silver bowl. Short-stemmed flowers look their best like that. Yes, Mama is right. It's hard to tell if the bowl does more for the flowers or the other way around. I better hurry. I will be late for school.
Late?
Yes, late. Slowly I creep back to reality. I will be late because we are going away from here. Why is it all so hard? The war will end soon, and we will all be back home. Somehow the thought brought no comfort. I felt weighed down in my heart that I would never be back again. A bird fluttered in the branches above me. Somewhere a dog barked. I embraced the twisted branch and kissed its rough, wet bark. Goodbye, goodbye, I murmured. Where were you? Mama asked when I went downstairs again. Out in the garden, I answered. Then I saw Nyanya sitting on an old kitchen chair. She had braved danger to come to us. Papa was urging her to go. She refused. A wagon drawn by an old sleepy horse pulled up in front of the house, and a peasant with his son started to load our meager belongings. Then Nyanya embraced Mama, and they both cried. She grabbed Papa's hand, and before he could protest, she kissed it.
You brought up my grandchild. You gave me a home for 13 years. I loved you like my own son.
Papa embraced her and kissed her cheek. She wept on his shoulder, and looking at me, she said,
It was morning like this when she was born.
You carried her in your arms toward the window. You said she was your princess, our little sunshine princess. Where are you taking her now? Her voice was terrible. Where? She repeated. Then Nyanya started to pray. Papa and Mama lowered their heads. The wardrobe and Mama's and Papa's beds were on the wagon. The furniture was mildewed from the dampness in the cellar. It looked strange and unfamiliar on the wagon. We took a last look into every corner of the cellar. How gladly we would have stayed here. How desirable the cellar looked. The peasant snapped the reins.
Ketavio! Ketavio!
The old horse began to walk. Slowly the cart started to move. Papa and Mama and I followed the wagon with bowed heads, as though walking behind a hearse. Here and there neighbors looked from behind curtains, waved mute farewells, wiping tears into handkerchiefs. Papa and Mama didn't see them. Papa carried the pot of chives, Mama her black shopping bag with our bread, our salt, the dried peas, the precious cocoa and jam. I still clutched the violets I had picked. When we reached the bend of the street where Arthur had slowed down, instinctively Papa and Mama slowed down too. They wanted to look back, I knew, but at the crucial moment Papa took Mama's hand and they went on. I looked back, though, the only one who did so. No one was in sight. The tree branches swung in the mild breeze. The windows of our home gleamed in the sunlight. Chapter 11. Before I opened my eyes, I felt the peculiar strangeness of waking in an unfamiliar room. Most peculiar was the brightness. I was used to the darkness of our cellar. When I opened my eyes, there in the sunlight was our old furniture, shabbier than I had imagined, but at the same time clean and bright. Both Papa and Mama, with whom I shared our one room, were in much better spirits than I remembered in a long time. The thing that we had feared most was done. The act of moving was over. We had never lived anywhere else before. There had always been our home, the garden, the attic, the shacks in the yard, the garden house.
Somewhere in the back of my mind, I had always felt that the walls of our home would protect us. Now I fully understood why we had dreaded the move to the ghetto.
The ghetto consisted of a number of buildings, of which only three faced the street.